Now, developing your communication skills and listening to your patients is never about reciting a script, making a conversation or anything else. Your intention should be to help answer the patient's questions. Let them make the decisions in their mind when they are ready. A dental practice is not a fast food drive-through with a pick and choose menu. This is dental healthcare. We shouldn't be talking at our customers, and that is why scripts do not work. This is way more than just a first patient consultation call. It's the first human contact and the start of a patient-dentist relationship that has to be built on trust. And not just because the GDC says so, but because that is what we all sign up for in any role in dentistry. To serve our patients. This is healthcare. Remember, care is about the welfare of others. Healthcare is about the welfare of the health of others. So if it's about the others, we need their perspective first, don't we? Well, that's what we'll explore in this part. The relationship of consent and perspective taking. Oh, and remember the word cares, because we'll be coming back to it again and again and again. Back to the Three Musketeers.
Thank you, Jason, Freya. That was a great introduction. Now, video one, we told you how not to do it. Kevin, 0.1 on that. You weren't very happy, were you?
Not at all, not at all. Just 0.1.
Just zero.
Lower if I could.
Why did they get a 0.1?
Well, because it was basically more words which were designed to get what's in it for you as a clinician rather than focusing on the right thing for the patient, fundamentally.
I think that direction isn't great at all at any level. I suppose at some level we're always going to start with what's in it for us. Well, not with what we offer, because the patient's going to find it through Google marketing or, I don't know, Facebook ads or something like that, right? And if you think just marketing, and it'd be interesting to start with that, we could market from our view. We offer this, we offer this, we offer this. Or we could market it from the patient's view. You know, are you having these challenges? Are you having these problems? Does this bug you? Or anything like that. Two different angles there, right? However, by the time they come to you, they've only seen generic information. Are you having pain? Well, in dentistry, pain is cured like this, that box package of a flyer. And then they come into your chair. That's what we were really saying. By the time they're in your chair, it's a different conversation. It's not a conversation of, let me reread the textbook to you. Agreed?
Agreed, yeah. Because if you give them too much information, if you churn a textbook out at a patient, they will not understand a lot of it. And I think if you could then be accused of being guilty of giving them too much information such that they don't understand what's going on. And again, this is part of Montgomery, but it's also part of the GDC standards. And the GDC standards actually say you should give patients all the information that they feel they need in order to make an informed decision. And Montgomery's the same. You know, you can't turn around to a patient and give them every single bit of literature surrounding a decision, but you can give them all the information that's pertinent to their particular situation, as long as you understand what their situation is, in order to give them the relevant information. And that's about giving them the relevant information as well. There's a case that's going to be coming out fairly soon where they will probably now go into what is a reasonable amount of information to actually give a patient in order for them to make a decision. Because a lot of people have had a misunderstanding of Montgomery that it's almost that you've got to give them every single possible option under the sun. But some of those won't be reasonable. You know, for instance, is it reasonable as an option for a patient who's got, say, a deep occlusal restoration? Do you give some patients the option that there's an extraction? Now, most people wouldn't, but if you've worked out that in a patient's belief system, if they are of the opinion that all fillings eventually fail, and I've had a few patients, you know, coming from a traditional mining town, fillings for some of the older population were... they just used to cause me problems, so I'll have the tooth out, so they won't have a fill-in. But does that mean you've got to give that option to every single patient when quite obviously it isn't an option normally to do a small occlusal restoration and extraction wouldn't be an option? Mm-hmm. And people have had this lack of clarity as to what, you know, their particular conversation would mean when related to Montgomery.
And we've seen this, Simon, haven't we, when we're working with dentists, particularly younger dentists. I would say as a general rule of thumb, for most patients that you see, you will know more about dentistry and the treatment than the patient sat there. Now, you arm that level of knowledge with the fact that fear, if you like, the fear of not giving enough information, the likelihood is you give them a heck of a lot. The right amount of information for a patient to make a decision is the right amount of information for a patient to make a decision. The question is, how do you find that out? And we'll come on to that. But the other extreme, I don't think it's totally hypothetical, but what happens when a patient treats another dentist? Dentists must go somewhere for their dentistry, right? So how much information does another dentist for treating another dentist give, for example? It wouldn't be everything. So two dentists chatting to each other, I'm sure if Simon started to lecture Drew on perio, he would look like a bit of a numpty. And yet, he might do that if he feels he's got to give everything. So yes, it's an extreme, but we do know instinctively, we do have to adjust the amount of information we give a patient according to the patient.
But then that puts a question here. And that's a fairly, to me, that's an important question because it goes back to the care and the trust bit we talked about in there. What is relevant for the patient? Don't we have to, it's perspective taking. This video is all about, but don't we have to look at it from the patient perspective to understand that?
We do, and I think you've got to start thinking, is there a difference between what you want as right. a dentist from a consultation with the patient and what the patient wants? So be a dentist here. It's the conversation is this: what outcome do you want when you see a patient? And that could be from the first time or for a subsequent conversation. What are your, if you like, measures of success? What is doing a good job? What does that look like from your point of view as a dentist? What do you then say generally when you're talking to patients? I don't mean necessarily the exact words, but what is the message that you're trying to get across? And how do you behave? And those four things, I know you want the listeners and learners to focus on now, Drew, but they're the four things that we have to think of it first of all from our perspective as
patients. So let's just take a break and listen to this. Write it down on a piece of paper. Get paper, a pen, a marker, anything. Four questions. Here's the four questions, right? The first one. What is, in your view, the most important outcome for you in any conversation for a patient as a clinician? What's the most important outcome for you? Question two, what's your measurement for success? What's your measurement of success? The third question is that what do you say? What do you focus on saying when you talk to your patients? What do you say? And the fourth question is, what are the most important behaviors? How do you behave? What is more important for you in the way you behave in that patient interaction? We'll give you a few minutes to write these four questions down. We'll leave them on the screen so you can refer back to them while Jason and Freya do something funny on the other side of the screen as well. Few minutes, write those down because that is so important. We're talking about perspective first in this part. So I want you to really take that on board. And when you write something down, you probably, there's something about tactile sensation, you process it more. That's why I'm saying write it down, don't just sit there. You've written down those four things that are important to you. And we kind of laid them out, you know, what's important to you, what outcome you want, you know, how you measure success, what do you say, and your behaviors. Now we want to look at a different, let's turn that 360, but just as we do, you were speaking about this case that's going to come out, Simon. What's, tell us a little bit more about that, for what you know, because I assume all the details are not out yet.
Yeah, there's a case going through the Supreme Court at the moment, and I think it's called McCulloch, and I think it's versus some hospital or somewhere, and it's the tension between Montgomery and Bolam, where Bolam has always said that if there is a group of like-minded peers or a respected body of professionals who would give this information. And this is where consent originally came from, is that consent was based on BOLA, and that if a group of peers would have, a group of professionals would have given this amount of information, then it wasn't negligent to not give that amount of information, if that makes sense, such that the clinician got to decide whether or not the information was relevant or not. And of course, Montgomery turned that on its head by saying that it's the material risk and that the patient should be allowed to decide a lot of what is relevant, and you should give them enough information to allow them to make that decision. Yes. But of course then, is that every single bit of information that can possibly be given, as in what is reasonable, what is unreasonable? And I think this case now is going to look potentially, I need to read the previous two cases, and it's only just been brought to my attention, but I need to look at that, because the tension will be in this: what is a reasonable amount of information to give the patient, and is this case going to be based on BOLM principles deciding what is the right amount of information, but then applied to Montgomery, that Montgomery then says it's still down to the patient to decide what is relevant. And I think this could clarify Montgomery a little bit better, because I think a lot of people have just assumed that they have to give every single option under the sun, which can get complicated, potentially confuse a patient. But there's been the risk, I think, that people think, well, if I don't give them all the information, could I be held negligent under Montgomery? And if this then clarifies what is reasonable, it may well make it a bit more straightforward, so people can understand, well, you should be giving this amount, and this is the amount of information that a reasonable body of professionals in the same field would give to that kind of patient. So you've got a little bit of Bowl and Montgomery playing together, but it will all transpire when the ruling comes out in the Supreme Court. So it's a watch this space for what actually that will then mean.
But what's important there, and I sort of gather, is Bolam was, what would your peers do? Montgomery was actually, no, look at your patient's perspective. And even if we merge the two, Bolam plus Montgomery, cause McCulloch or something, whatever it comes, it's about still trying to look at the patient perspective, right?
Absolutely, because the patient the patient has to come first.
Yeah.
And they will be making the decision based on what information you give them. And it's going to be important that you give them the correct amount of information, the right amount of information. But like everything, the law develops with other cases and other rulings. And that's how the British law works.
But then the question here becomes, we measured success as a dentist, the four things, and I asked the listeners for you to write it. If it's patient perspective, surely patient measures of success, well, should they be the same?
Well, you would hope so, wouldn't you? Because you're saying something about the tension. The stress comes from when the two parties are after different things. So really, to me, there should be representing the only patient in this conversation at the moment, there should be an absolute congruence between what you're trying to achieve as a clinician, your measures of success, how you speak and how you behave. Those really should be as aligned as possible with what I want as a patient, because my outcome as a patient, my measures of success, what I want to hear from you and how I want you to behave, I think those should be similar, if not identical, to it from your perspective. So you've got this congruence of communication. And it could be in any situation. Obviously, we're focusing here upon patients and dentists. It's that incongruence that creates the stress and the tension. When two parties understand each other because they both want the same thing from the same transaction, if you like, albeit from different perspectives, then that's a perfect relationship. And yet, again, it goes back to the points we've been making. What would set you off course from that as a clinician is if you have other interests at heart, other stakeholders. What is going to feel good as a patient is if I feel that you're best interests are my best interests too. And that's what I'm really looking for as a patient.
An example there would be if some patients will ask about success rates, and it can be quite difficult giving success rates in dentistry because of the individual nature of what we do. I might have a success rate on certain types of endo of 90% plus. Other people might have success rates of 75% or 80%, and it doesn't necessarily mean that we're doing it differently, we just mean in our case choice is different. But if a patient were to come in and we were only basing our information on 90% plus success rates, so anything below that, you just say to a patient, it's not worth doing. Actually, look at it the other way around. For some people, they will actually have the mindset, well, a 90% failure rate is actually a 1 in 10 chance that it might work, and those are the odds that my risk system will allow me to take. So again, this is where it comes down to finding enough out about the patient, because you're now talking about what's your aversion to risk. How would you like me to treat this tooth? This is a bit of a grey area, because I've just said in this case that you don't have to give them every option. But would it be reasonable sometimes to give some of the options that are maybe a little bit off the wall? Because you think, well, look, you know, I know what your appreciation of risk is. You are someone who absolutely doesn't want to have a tooth out or do that. I can perhaps do something that carries with it a much lower success rate, as long as you accept it, because you're a person who will see any chance of success. The line comes is where, you know, where do you draw it?
It's how you frame it and knowing your patient.
It's how you frame it,
exactly. Now, there's a study on that, and I'll tell you about that in a bit. It was about how people were quoted surgical success and failure rates for some cancer therapy versus radiotherapy. It's very interesting, but what this is underlining, very importantly, is the patient perspective. And what we want to do as the next exercise for you, the next exercise is really important here, is do those four questions again. But this time, close your eyes. Imagine you are the patient sitting in the very chair rather than being the dentist that was on the side. So you're set on your dental chair and the dentist's face is hovering above you. As that patient sat there, what are the most important outcomes for you? What outcomes do you want as a patient? As a patient, what is your measure of success? You know, how do you measure success of the treatment, the dentist, the hygienist, or the dental nurse working with them, whoever is going to provide? Number three there is that when you are there, what do you as a patient, what do you hear your dentist saying? What are the things that you want your dentist to say? And the fourth one is behaviors. How do you want your dentist to behave? What do you want your dentist to be doing? We're going to give you a few moments just to write that down. Remember, paper and pen or pencil, write it down. It's the best way to do it. We'll put those four questions on the screen. Jason or Freya doing something funny on the side to entertain you at the same time. So, how did you get on? You've now actually written on one page, as a dentist, what the four outcomes you prefer are. And as a patient, what you think those four outcomes are. Do they match? Are they equal? Are they congruent? That's what you were referring to, right? Because so many times we look at our measures as KPI, as targets, as, I don't know, units of dental activity, whatever it is. Is that what the patient's worried about? And when we were talking about trust and care in video one and about getting understood, well, perspective is the first thing. If you don't understand someone's perspective, and your measures and outcomes and what you're looking for different to the expectations of somebody else, you've already started going on a different direction. And that's why we were talking about not just the outcomes, but how those outcomes are framed for your patient, which is where we were talking about the McCulloch and Malik studies. Malik, you talked about.
That's right. These are cases that are currently, so at the time of recording this, which is June 2023, the McCulloch case is yet to be decided on by the Supreme Court, but there has been another recent case called Malik versus St. George's Hospital, where there is this tension about what is a reasonable amount of information to give the patient, and that could well be where Bolam kicks in to refine part of Montgomery. Now, these are all sort of cases that it can get complex when talking to, you know, we're clinicians, we're not lawyers, but it's interesting, we need to understand where the risk is to us if something isn't explained, because we have double jeopardy in effect. We have the risk of being sued, and I know that's a concern that a lot of our younger practitioners have, and we have the GDC. And whilst the GDC have made efforts to improve, there is still a significant worry, I think, that they will see and they will take things and take them and prosecute them to the nth degree. So we need to inoculate ourselves against that. So an understanding of, not so that you can quote case names verbatim, but to understand the thinking behind the legal process that goes into this, so that you can get a feel for what the judiciary, because effectively they're the people who we are threatened by, what are their thought processes when discussing these whole communication, consent, what should you say to a patient, what should you tell them, what is enough information.
But it's perspective again, right?
Absolutely.
Getting into the perspective of the patient. Now, you know, the study I was telling you, actually, I've got the numbers here, right? So it was about patients who were offered the option of either surgery or radiotherapy. Now, in one group of patients, they said that 90% of patients who, 90% of patients who underwent surgery survived the treatment. Okay. 34% still survived 5 years later, surgery. Then they were told about radiotherapy, and they said 100% of patients who underwent radiotherapy survived after treatment, but only 22% survived 5 years later. That was survival. Then the other group of patients were given the other frame, where the other frame was basically 10% of patients who underwent surgery died, but after 5 years, 66% died. And radiotherapy, 0% died after radiotherapy immediately, but 78% died after 5 years. Now, those are lots of numbers, but what we're saying is they were given survival statistics of surgery, one group, and the other ones were given non-survival failure death statistics, right? And actually, if you think about it, these patients were given the same stats, just different perspectives. Here's the thing, with the survival frame, only 15% of the patients chose radiotherapy and preferred surgery. But the failure frame, the mortality frame, 42% chose radiotherapy. That's a huge difference. Mm. And all on the basis of whether you quoted success or failure. And you were saying this about these cases, that you can quote 90% or 80% root canal success, but for that patient, what's more important, success or failure? And you were saying some patients who had belief system feelings never work. So they're more interested in failure because I've had previous failure feelings. But this to me is saying the basis of trust and communication is perspective. And the exercise we've done, dentist and patients, are you all on the same perspective of success, of expectations, of outcome? Because it's going to change the way your patient thinks and chooses treatment, right? But isn't perspective also how they select the dental practice?
It is, and I think if we stand in the shoes of our patients for a moment, it's dawned on me over the years that there is a question that every patient you've ever seen will have thought about, or at least gone to find the answer to. And there's a question that every patient you'll ever want to see we'll need to find the answer to this. And if I explain what that question is in a moment, but why patients are having to ask this question and they're searching for an answer that increasingly they're not getting on a Google search. They're having to go what I would call, and I'll explain this in a moment, the wheelie bin search engine. Then if we understand why patients are asking that question and they're not getting the answers online, it provides us with incredible insight into what people really, I know what you're going to say, Simon. You're going to say wheelie now, aren't you?
Wheelie, yeah.
What patients really want, right? Really want. And, you know, this whole conversation has been about perspectives. your perspective as clinicians, our, if you like, perspective as patients. And where those two things, there's sufficient common ground, we've got a basis for a good relationship. So the question I'm hearing people ask, and you'll notice this question being asked more and more online in dental groups and forums, the question being asked is, can anybody recommend a? Now, on this occasion, can anybody recommend a dentist? And I saw this not so long ago in our local community neighbourhood watch WhatsApp group. Somebody asked a question, can anybody recommend a dentist? Now, I know a few dentists, so I recommended this chap, okay? But which, who, by the way, I don't think is the cheapest, and rightly so. Geographically, I don't think he's often the closest. In fact, I'll let you into a secret. I'm not even sure he's a dentist. I've never checked, right? But from the perspective of people I just happened to share a street with and put my wheelie bin out with on a Sunday night, and that's what I mean, a metaphor, a fairly surface-level relationship, it seems that people would sooner ask someone they don't know that well on the basis he or she might know someone who might know someone who hopefully happens to be a dentist we can actually trust. And that's the conversation at the wheelie bin search engine. And when you hear people asking that, I saw one the other day, can anybody recommend, and it was loops. And I thought, surely loops are loops, right? Clearly not. There's a lot to loops. Can anybody recommend a gardener, a plumber, a course or whatever? You see, the reason we're asking this question is because we don't trust the internet.
Yeah.
It's failed us. We don't trust the internet as much as we think we do. So we're seeking something which we can't get digitally. We're not getting that reassurance. And I know what you're thinking. I accused Simon of being a grumpy old man earlier, which of course is largely true. I know you're thinking this because I'm a grumpy old man. I was born before the internet was a thing, right, in the 70s. This is not an old person thing. It's a young person thing too. Young persons, Gen Z, Z, millennials, whatever we call them at the moment, go on the TikTok and see how many hours they spend recommending what's in a box to other people of the same generation. So it's not an old person or a young person thing. We're seeking reassurance and we need, if you like, humanity for that. And again, I know what you're thinking, you've got your website and all the rest of it. Your patients choose you because you strive to deliver the highest level of patient care in a warm, friendly environment using all of your needs, and you've got whatever many recommendations and all the rest of it.
And you're in a warm practice.
And whatever, right? Well, yeah, but we're all obsessed with getting it better. Our online reputations are not that good. They can't be. Otherwise, why are we always trying to improve them? Myself included. So we know our online reputation isn't perfect. We know patients, customers, society are not getting what they want purely digitally, if you like. It's not serving us. So weirdly, in this increasingly digital age, the most powerful search engine on the planet, from what I've seen, is the wheelie bin search engine. It's not Google. Because as a patient or potential patient, I can go all over the internet and still conclude, yeah, I need some extra reassurance. And I will go to someone who might know someone who hopefully might be a dentist I can actually trust. And again, this is not a new thing. If we go back to the 1970s, Robert Cialdini talked about the power of social proof. Okay, social proof, safety in numbers. Again, it's a similar thing. And if we understand why this exists, because we don't trust the digital world as much as we think we do, it's telling patients what they want, because the conversation at the wheelie bin search engine is not about occlusion or margins, or even whether you've hit whitening, straightening status, diamond, platinum, gold, or whatever. I'm there because there's something in it for me, and I want you to understand me. And again, we only have to look back a few years in our modern social history, and I'm going through to lockdown here. Remember those days?
Yes.
Of course we do. Difficult times and all the rest of it, but for many of us, the highlight of our week, right? You remember this? Obviously, my highlight of my week was listening to one of your live things on Tubules, Drew. But for many of us, the highlight of our week, and you remember this at home, standing on our doorsteps on a Thursday night and clapping and banging a saucepan right? That was the highlight of our fairly dull weeks. And the reason it was the highlight was because when we had human interaction forced, taken away from us because of lockdown, we craved that human connection. We don't have to look that far back to see when you take that human connection out of how we normally interact as a society, we crave it. And that's my point. The internet does not give you that human connection. And if I'm going to instruct you or the people representing you or the profession representing you to stick your hands in my mouth and move me out of either physical or emotional pain towards physical or emotional pleasure, I can't get that purely digitally. I need a feeling, and I can get that from other human beings. That's what we really want. Forget all your technical stuff a second. Right at the very outset, can I trust you to move me out of physical or emotional pain towards physical or emotional pleasure? And trust is a behaviour. It comes from, and I'm conscious people listening will be medical people, but my understanding is trust comes from the limbic system. The limbic system deals with feelings. It doesn't deal with language. It's been around longer than we've been doing language.
There's a superficiality as well to the internet in for that very reason, because by virtue of what it is, it's a visual presentation. Even if it's just, you know, videos, words, pictures, it's not the physical being in the same space and time as another human being, which a consultation is. And I think, you know, you've hit the nail on the head there with what you were saying about, was it Robert Cialdini? That there's got to be that human connection.
People and like people who are like themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And that's another interesting thing, that people who like people generally then don't go on to sue them or complain about them. So being liked by someone is probably as important to protect yourself as giving the right kind of consent. And in order to sort of avoid being sued and avoid landing in front of the GDC, I think you'll probably find that in a lot of the cases, there's a huge amount of communication failure that eventually leads to these eventual outcomes that, you know, quite a threatening and distressing complaint can result from.
I think these are important layers to think about, because what we are saying is that patients want trust, very important, but that trust building starts even before they've found your practice. They've already spoken to somebody else to try and get a recommendation, which means that their perspective is already building. The patient's thought process, expectations, everything's building. Then they call your practice and come in. And actually, you as a dentist, is your measure of success similar to that patient who's come in? Because that patient's measure of success is probably similar to the person who recommended them. Just think about the chain of events. Quite interesting. And actually, that's why sometimes when you've built a practice for a long term and you've had patients follow you for a long term, you kind of probably get less chance of being complained or sued against, because you're now getting a group of people who all share the same thought process.
Well, this is the tribal kind of thing, isn't it? People like to flock together to a tribe, and you see what success that's had with tubules. But in a smaller scale, that's exactly the same as a dental practice. Like-minded people will recommend like-minded people to your practice. And if you enjoy treating that kind of patient, one of the best things you can do from a marketing point of view is say to people like that, are the people like yourself who you could recommend? You know, you have search engine optimization and things like that, but still one of the most fundamental, I think, recommendations you can get is the word of mouth. And that,
well, and in a way, it's almost sad that that's the case. The internet should be providing enough reassurance to people. Hell, it's big enough, right? The internet's big enough to provide patients with enough reassurance. However, it doesn't. Not all the time. And therefore, particularly in healthcare. So that's why we're seeking something else. And you mentioned this, the strength of the word of mouth recommendation. What is that word? What are those words coming out of patients' mouths when they're talking to other people that want to be seen or served by you? And it's about being understood. My dentist listened to me. If I was having a conversation with a third party about their wonderful dentist, I'd be asking, well, what do you like about him or her? And the words I'm likely to hear are, not just he's a nice guy or he's a nice lady, but yes, my dentist understands me. So one of the most powerful things, and I would encourage everybody to do this, whether you get your reception team on board with this or you ask the patient yourselves, probably more powerful if you get your reception team to ask the question. When the patient has left the surgery and they go to the desk to pay or to process and to go to the next appointment or whatever, as well as the niceties, how about we ask this question? Did you understand what the dentist said to you in the surgery?
Did it make sense?
Did it make sense? Now, not only does that reassure the patient that we care about them, because we're asking a very caring question, not did you sign up, not did you put the ink to the paper, not did you do something that's in it for someone else, what's in this for you? Did you understand it? We could do a lot worse than just ask patients all day, did you understand the treatment that was explained to you? Now, we need to be prepared that they might say no. So worst scenario, they say no, and we get a chance to explain it again to them. I call that a double win, if you like, right? So worst scenario, they say no. Best scenario, they say yes, but we can deal with the no. And not only does that reassure the patient that we care, it also reassures the patient that it reminds them they do understand it. So you were speaking earlier about consent. The last thing I would want a patient thinking when they're signing the consent form is they're emotionally upset. The best state of mind to put someone in, genuinely, and assuming it's true, is, do I understand this before I sign the contract? And that's why asking that question is incredibly powerful and probably a safer thing to do than some of the other nonsense.
Absolutely. So it's not what you say. In all of this, the message coming out is why you say it and almost how you say it. Now, if anybody's not a fan of Simon Sinek, then...
You should be.
You should be. The three circles. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it, then they think about the how and the what, right? And we've been focusing on those two inner circles. People don't buy what communication you do, they actually buy how and why. And we've spent a lot of time on why, because without that basis, everything else falters. Communication is about an exchange of feelings almost, I feel. It's an exchange of emotion. And emotion exchange in the right way, you get right result. Emotion exchange in the wrong way, you get buyer's Kellogg's cereal remorse, right? That's what it is. So before you even start on this course and think, what was the reason? I came here to tell patients what to do and I want to know what to do to build rapport, because that's what we do as dentists. I want to know what to do. Which drill do I use? Which burr do I use? Which blade? No, try and understand why. The wheelie bean search engine's about the why. Understanding perspective about the why. Understanding building trust and care is about the why. So just before we finish, what's the acronym WILLY? Have you thought about it? Has it got something in it?
Yeah, I think the W, if you like, is what we say and the reason behind what we say. There's how we speak to our patients and the case for kindness. It's a fairly strong case. You're in healthcare. And we spoke about this earlier, that empathy is a state of mind. It's not a tick box. That your intention, your treatment plans, how you propose to help a patient should be detached from what's in it for you. In other words, your ego.
That's the other E.
That's the other E. Where are we up to? And the L, that loyalty and trust, it's a feeling. You can behave in a trustworthy way. But we instinctively know if someone's trying to leg us up. That's been proven now with functional MRI scans, by the way, that brain activity mirrors brain activity. So if my intention is to do something with the teeth in your mouth in order for me to get an outcome, I'm on the attack, if you like. And of course, the patient's going to pick up on that. And so they're either going to attack back or they're going to recall back. So we know people would pick up on that, and that explains, and Simon Sinek makes a very good point about this sometimes, we have the ability to process enormous amounts of facts and figures, and dentists, you can cite lots of facts and figures, but sometimes a human being will say no to another human being just because it doesn't feel right. And that's back to what you were saying. It's got to start with the why. The I and the E of the WHEALEY acronym, of course, is things that in everyday life that matter to you, probably also matter to your patients. So, for example, if you are staying quiet as a business, as a profession, as an individual, on things that society probably think you should have an opinion or a voice on, then, yeah, people are starting to vote with their feet. We've seen this in recent years, the emergence of the values-based buyer. We'll go to companies and businesses that feel more like them because of the way they behave. And again, that explains why you could have two identical products or services, and yet one of those businesses will have a queue of people waiting and the other will be in decline. So yes, WHEALEY, what we say, how we say it, empathy, ego, loyalty and trust, and things that matter in everyday life. This is where we've been speaking about the common ground, when two parties understand each other and have a shared common interest.
So when we start going from that perspective of communication, I've changed the frame for you now, if you get that. If we go from that frame of trust, care, perspective, changes a different game, right? How you talk to patients, what you do.
Yeah, yeah. And it also pays different attention to what is a measure of success. Yes. And that's a phrase, the term we've been using. From a patient's point of view, if you do things that are of beneficial to me, and however counterintuitive it is, as a dentist, that isn't about more, it's about better, then those are the things we should be measuring. Yes, we can have the KPIs and the numbers and the percentages and all the rest of it, but the conversation out there in the world of the public,
yes,
is about humanity. It's about trust, it's about emotions and about feelings. Yes, those things are harder to measure. It's easy to measure occupancies and UDAs and FDAs and all the rest of it. But those emotional measures of success, they're where we should be putting our focus, not on the digital measures of success. That latter priority of putting the digital outcomes first is actually saying that we're not putting our patients first, and I think that's dangerous.
And I've always said this, what can be measured is not always the important thing. And whatever's important can't always be measured easily, because it's more qualitative. And if we now go back to those three case scenarios we saw in part one, suddenly, it wasn't just rudeness and obnoxiousness. There's so much more missing there, right? When we see that.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no questions asked, you said. No. There was this conversation going on. I'm going to tell you what's in my head, but that perspective was missing. All the things we said just didn't turn up. What do you think? They didn't. Okay. Now, we can't tell people what to say, though, because each case is individual.
You can't script a relationship with another human being, particularly, no. Because then it becomes an act and people will see through it. And some people are very perceptive. And they will know. I remember a patient who came in to see me once as a new patient, and literally the first thing he said, I've been to see a practice near you, and all they were trying to do is some weird conversation designed to sell me products that I didn't necessarily want or I didn't know I needed. And he said, and I can see straight through that. And it was just the language patterns. Patients will pick up on these, I'd say, malign, potentially, conversation patterns and traits. And you know, you may be lucky and you may avoid the GDC and you may avoid litigation, but then again, you might not. And for me, I want to just practice safely and to the best interests of my patients. And I've measured KPIs. You know, it's important that we do have these mechanisms of measurement of business success, because fundamentally we have to have the business running and the business running effectively. And it's not actually a dirty word to have a successful business. The GDC recognise, even though it says you will always act in the patient's best interests and not in the financial best interests of yourself, there is a tension there that when there's a transactional relationship, we are taking money off our patients. So we have to have a business income in order to survive as practitioners. But that has to be done with integrity and humility at times.
I mean, it's what comes first. If we look back in recent modern history, and again, at risk of sounding like the grumpy old man again, but in the 80s and 90s, it was all of that, the stuff, at the expense of everybody and everything else. So it was more, it was the KPIs, it was the numbers, it was the interests of the financiers, if you like, at the expense of people. The people that worked in those businesses and the people that allegedly those businesses were trying to serve. It's the wrong way around. If we look after the people that work with us, for us, and the people that we are to serve, then the trade-off for doing a good job there is, if you like, those digital measures, the KPIs, the money, all the rest of it. And you're absolutely right, I've said before, the money buys the fuel to go in the engine, but where are you going? So let's not be scared of these digital measures, but let's not score those measures at the expense of everybody and everything else. We continue to do the right thing for our patients and the results will follow. And that puts a very, very different perspective on a dental practice. And again, if you look outside of dentistry, those businesses that are doing particularly well, and guess what? The ones that we trust are focusing on the humanity, if you like, before the more. So it's better as well as more, but it's not doing better or more at the expense of everybody and everything else.
Now we get that base, we still need some kind of structure to communication.
Of course.
What is it about effective communicators? What do all good communicators do that really then starts delivering this foundation?
Yeah, I think fundamentally, Drew, we've talked about the first thing is they understand why they're saying whatever it is they're about to say. And we should always be thinking about that. We've spent between us now many years looking at how we communicate with our patients. But it always comes back to, if we're going to help people get better with their communication skills, I want to think, well, why are we doing that? And what is that other human being going to do with them? So yes, we have got to start with why, but all consistently successful human behaviour, and I'm guess clinically it's the same for you, there's some kind of structure to it. A structure that allows us to be flexible enough with our behaviours that we're not in a silo, but also allows us to, well, it feels good for the patient as well, right? The sense there's an element of, where is this going? There's a common sense to it. Sitting above all of that is to be detached from what's in it for you, because that's what the patient will pick up on. Again, it doesn't matter how wonderful your communication skills are. If you're trying to get someone over on someone, they're either going to pick up on it or eventually they're going to pick up on it. So all good, all consistently successful human behaviour has a structure to it. But here's the thing. I think you two are both successful people, right? I mean, you might argue differently, but I think you're very successful people. Successful people have, and anybody has, throughout their lives, we've all had the ability to communicate with other human beings. You've been doing it since you were born, okay? I don't think you need to be taught how to communicate with other human beings, because everything you've achieved in your life, the success you've had, has come from your ability to communicate with other human beings. Getting fed, right, was your ability to influence another human being. What we do need to do is shine some light on what makes you consistently successful, because what works with one patient might not work with another. Now, that's your problem. Some people call that an objection. I call it, you've not been understood yet. And again, this is about the state of mind that we're in. If you label something, or that patient doesn't say yes to me, hasn't said yes to me, therefore it's an objection, that's a hark back to the mis-selling of the 80s and 90s for a start. So if you label something an objection, if I say to Simon, I object to you, it changes both of our state of minds. If I remain curious, if I ask more questions and see it as, he just doesn't understand me yet, then that helps me step more in Simon's shoes, the patient's shoes, and seek to be understood, not to make a fight or a battle. So I would say structure, state of mind, and remain curious longer.
Well, that's an interesting place to go, because you came to this communication course to give me a recipe. Well, recipe ain't going to happen, but we're going to give you a good structure in the next part. Remember, I kept saying we need to care, the word cares. That's where we're going to go next in video 3, because all consistently good communicators have a certain structure, certain pillars. It's like you can't have a recipe to make certain good food, right? I can give you the recipe, but you'll vary it every time, depending on what's available or what's missing or what your situation is. Eventually, it's making a good meal every time, knowing what structure there is. Well, this time we're preparing the recipe for a good structure, so you have the best communication with your patients, day in, day out, consistently. That's a good way to go, I think. I hope you've enjoyed this part, perspective taking. Walk, start talking to your team members, get that perspective in anything, practice it. Practice makes you better. Nothing ever makes you perfect. Perfection is elusive. But if you keep getting better and better, we'll give you the structure next. See you in the next part.
There we are. Structure, state of mind, and remain curious longer. How important is this? You now have the why and the why not. So now let's discuss the how. The structure of communication follows in part 4. See you there.